we're talking about the role of the Federal Reserve as our economy emerges from the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So a number of data points to watch, not to mention the debate among Fed policymakers. Do you pull back on the unprecedented economic interventions? Do you raise interest rates sooner to prevent the economy from overheating? And what about potential inflation shock? Your questions on how the Fed works, 800-642-1234. Heather Long is an economic correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, great to be here.
So the Federal Reserve can be a confusing institution. Can you start out by giving us a little bit of a primer here? Start out by explaining what the Fed is and how it works.
Yes. So, basically, they're an organization that is trying to keep the economy on a good path. And the main ways that they do that are to raise and lower interest rates. And those are the rates that ultimately flow through the economy and that's influencing the rates that a lot of people across the country get when you go to get a mortgage or an auto loan, how much that's going to cost or open a business, or if you have a savings account, how much interest are you getting on that savings? So when they raise those rates, it's good for savers, but harder to borrow money. And when they lower those rates, as they did last year during the crisis, it makes it really cheap to borrow money and not so good for savers.
So why do we need a Federal Reserve? Why do we need an institution that, you know, provides banks and financial services to the U.S. government?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of people argue that there's a reason that most stable, large economies around the world have a central bank like the Federal Reserve. And the reason is it's generally an independent organization. So they try to make decisions that are not influenced by politics. There's a lot of reasons you wouldn't want, say, Congress or even a White House deciding what the interest rates are, because they would generally just keep them as low as possible in order to try to get the economy juiced up before re-election. So that's why most countries around the world have gone to these independent central banking systems. Similarly, with the other thing that the central bank does is it play a role in bank regulation. There's a debate if they're doing a good enough job, particularly around things like the great financial crisis of a decade ago, but they both monitor the overall economic conditions and monitor the bank and financial systems.
Yeah, I mean, there was the huge bank bailout of the 2008 financial crisis. What was the role of the Federal Reserve there?
The United States has kind of a complicated financial regulation system, and some people say the big flaw is that the regulation is done by too many different entities. So I think the bigger flaw a lot of people think for the Federal Reserve is they didn't recognize early enough, say in like 2006 or 2007, what a role the housing market was. Basically too hot. Too mm-hmm. many people were borrowing money. We know this in hindsight, but too many people were obviously borrowing money who really shouldn't have been able to get those loans. And the Fed probably didn't act fast enough. They could have raised those interest rates, made it a lot harder to borrow money to cool down that housing market. And in hindsight, I think a lot of people on the Fed board then regret not taking more action.
Heather Long is with us, economic correspondent at The Washington Post, as we discuss the role of our nation's central bank and as we look at efforts to help bring economic stability in these times through monetary policies. You can join in. What do you want to know about how the Fed operates? Do you think that the central bank is doing a good job of managing our economic recovery? Should it do more in some areas? 800-642-1234. So, Heather, the Federal Reserve is made up of 12 regional banks, including ones based in Chicago and Minneapolis. What do these regional banks do apart from the national bank?
So when the Fed was created back in 1913, the idea was to not vest all the power in Washington, D.C. Mm. We were a growing country, and There were obviously different regional hubs, and similar to the way Congress works, the idea was we needed eyes and ears on the ground across the country to understand the different dynamics of the economy and to regulate banks and financial institutions across the country, not just in New York or in Washington. And so that's why the system was created with the 12 regional banks. And it seems a lot of people think it works pretty well. For instance, these interest rates decisions are not just made in Washington, D.C. They are made by a committee that has both members from Washington, D.C., but also they like the you're going to hear from Neel Kashkari, I believe, later,
yes,
the president of the Minneapolis Fed Bank. You know, he gets to vote on those interest rate decisions. It rotates. So every 3 years, he's a voting member of the committee, and he brings that perspective. You know, what's going on in the central and upper parts of the country, just like the Dallas Fed is bringing what's going on in the oil market. There's a representative from California who's bringing what's going on in parts of California and Silicon Valley. And so, you know, we are a diverse country with a lot of different regional variation, and that's the idea behind the 12 banks.
Yeah, so kind of rotating in those voting members. I think Kashkari is an alternate next year, but then in 2023, he's a voting member again. And so you can kind of see how they really bring different aspects of the country through their policy. I'm wondering, you know, the Fed sets the target for the Fed funds rate. And so if a bank doesn't have enough cash on hand at the end of the day, it borrows what it needs from other banks. And I'm wondering if you can help us explain the interconnectedness there of interest rates and the Fed funds rate.
Right. So that's the first mechanism that the Fed is using to influence the economy is, as you mentioned, a lot of banks at the end of the day, you know, maybe they've lent out a little bit too much and they don't have quite enough deposits. You know, they're trying to basically fine tune their books at the end of the day. And this is a common practice. It doesn't mean that the bank is not operating well. You know, big banks do this, small banks do this, and they go to the Federal Reserve to borrow money just for like a 24-hour period. So these are not loans for 30 years like most of us get for a mortgage. These are really short-term loans for the overnight lending market. And the rate that they're charged, that interest rate that they're charged by the Fed, ultimately influences when they turn around and what they're going to give in terms of the rates that they're offering their customers. So obviously they're going to offer something a little bit higher in order to make money than what they're getting from the Fed. But it's a way that the Fed can influence the economy right away. So they make a decision on an interest rate, it hits the news, and then overnight those rates can potentially move, and that is immediate transmission into the economy.
Yeah, ticking up or ticking down. So what does the Fed's Open Market Committee do?
So that is the fancy way of saying the group that decides the interest rates. So it has 12 members. So there's 12 official voting members each year, and then there's alternates. All 12 of the regional presidents we were talking about, like President Kashkari from the Minneapolis Fed, so all 12 of those sit at the table along with 7 members from Washington, D.C., who are appointed by the president and confirmed by Congress. So that whole group of nearly 20 is sitting around a huge conference table discussing the economy, and ultimately 12 of those actually get to vote. But really, the whole group is influencing the discussion. They spend 2 days every 6 weeks in Washington discussing, you know, how their two primary goals from Congress are to keep prices stable. So when you read about inflation, and inflation in May was the highest in 13 years at 5% year over year. So they're supposed to be keeping that number a lot closer to 2%. And the other thing they're supposed to be doing is keeping as many people as possible employed. So keeping unemployment as low as they think it can go. So that's sort of their mandate. Stable prices, maximum employment is the technical term they use, which just means as many people as possible in jobs.
Washington Post economic correspondent there, Heather Long, explaining what the Federal Reserve does. Are you worried that the Fed is paying too much attention or not enough to inflation? What changes would you like to see in how the Fed operates? How do you think the Fed is doing on monetary policy in responding to this pandemic economic crisis? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Heather Long on the Ideas Network. The Federal Reserve, it tries to manage inflation, supervises banks, maintains financial stability, provides banking services. We're discussing the Fed's role and what policymakers are thinking at this point in the recovery on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What worries you about the central bank of our country? Do you think the Fed is buying up too many assets? Are you concerned that the economy is being managed for the benefit of corporations and that working class struggling Americans will be left behind? 800-642-1234. Heather Long is economics correspondent at The Washington Post and stays with us. Heather, there's been debate over how much the Fed should worry about inflation. Can you explain how the thinking about inflation has evolved at the central bank?
This is the key debate of our time and certainly this summer in terms of the economy. It's very clear that prices are rising. Anyone who's tried to buy a used car lately has seen the sticker shock, or obviously these home prices in many parts of the country are shooting up, but also things like gallon of milk costs a lot more than it did a year ago. Bacon prices are also pretty hefty. So, the question isn't, do we have higher inflation than what we want right now? We do have higher inflation than what we want right now. The debate is whether this is going to be a short-lived phenomenon that's just the result of reopening from this horrible pandemic we've all been through. So there's just too much demand, too many people who want to go on vacation and want to buy dishwashers and other things right and use cars right now, and that ultimately the economy will stabilize and we'll get back to a good place by the end of the year? Or are we at the start of a nasty inflation cycle where prices are rising and then wages are rising as workers are demanding more money so they can still buy things? Then the restaurants and the producers have to raise prices again. Then the wages go up, this sort of dangerous inflation cycle that was so much of the country saw during the 1970s and early 1980s. So that's really the fundamental debate that's going on right now. And right now, the Federal Reserve and President Kashkari is part of that, who will be on later, is arguing that this inflation is not nasty, persistent 1970s style inflation, that this is just a quirk of the reopening. That's going to be the hot summer of inflation, and then it will go away.
Well, on that note on inflation, let's bring in Tim in Pembine. Tim, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I'm kind of like blitzkrieg. I was around back when you could go and you could fill up, go and take a station wagon and fill it up with groceries for $40, you know, and everything wasn't like it was. And not so many people were in debt. Most everybody had houses. There was more houses than apartments. So with everything going with the money, higher, how are we going to get control if we don't get control over pricing? It seems to always keep putting us in. We go to a plateau and we kind of forget. Prices never go down. We just wait till the next thing that causes the price to go up. So yeah. Then you got car mortgages now. Car mortgages are the next form of foreclosure, like the great house foreclosure was.
Yeah, Tim, thank you. Heather, how do you get control over pricing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great call that he made. That's one of the biggest concerns right now, is that obviously prices are high. People are feeling it, particularly a lot of baby boomers who are now retired. If you're living on a fixed income, you definitely feel those price increases with the gas higher and a lot of grocery prices are higher. And my big concern is what happens to rent prices. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see rents creep up. And obviously, that's a huge component of many people's budgets, is how much you pay on your monthly rent. And if you don't own your home, you know, your rent could go up potentially. So this is the biggest gamble right now. Right now, the Fed says, no, we need to still keep these interest rates low because we have, you know, basically 10 million people. We're still trying to get back into jobs. We're still in recovery mode. And we think think that we're watching inflation, but we don't think it's going to be a key lasting issue. But if they're wrong about that, they are going to have to act very quickly, potentially next year, to raise those interest rates and to slow that price growth that caller is rightly worried about. And if that happens, unfortunately, the Fed's track record is they usually send the economy into a recession.
You know,
so that's why there's so much discussion about it.
I've been thinking, you know, you've talked with so many people who are living on the margins, who are just scraping by in the pandemic, and probably were so as well before the pandemic struck. How can the Fed make sure that it's not just focusing on the big corporations and Wall Street and also helping the little people, if you will?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's obviously, there's a lot of debate if the Fed is doing enough, watching all parts of the United States economy and not just the wealthy and the big corporations. So the argument at the Fed, and President Kashkari has been a big part of this, is there's been a real sea change in sort of the last 2 to 3 years at the Fed. And they now are very focused on trying to get as many people to work as possible. And there's a lot of, right before the pandemic, we had some of the lowest unemployment rates and fastest wage growth that we had seen in years, really in decades. And there's a belief that the economy basically can run hotter, that we can have even more people working than we thought was possible. Like when I took economics in the early, 2000 to 2004 in college, the belief was that the ideal unemployment rate in the United States was 5%. Hmm. That is now balderdash, that now the belief is that we can get to 3%, or maybe even lower. And that, I can't tell you what a dramatic change that is in economic thinking. And that's really the argument at the Fed. They're like, yes, low interest rates. Yes, it's helping the stock market go bananas. Yes, it's helping these home prices go up, but it's also helping people get back to work. And that's the best way that we know how to help people, to help the working class.
We're talking with Heather Long, who's an economic correspondent at The Washington Post, as we look at the role of the Federal Reserve in managing and monitoring the economic recovery. Let's go to Vicki now in Mequon. Vicki, hi.
Hi. Oh, thanks for taking my call. You asked what my opinion is, and I listened to Chairman Powell's discussions. I've listened to Yellen. I've listened to the Fed for years, and I give them a 5-star. Their communication is outstanding. They try to communicate not just to the stock market. It's not all about what's happening in the stock market. They're an agency that was created by Congress. They're not just a, quote, institution. They're charged with, they have a dual mandate of full employment and to control inflation, which is a huge responsibility. And they don't just control money by the interest rates. They buy and sell securities that moves money in and out of the market and gives access to businesses across this country. Their roles with the banks is critical. The Federal Reserve, the amount of banks need to hold overnight or in perpetuity to help ensure their solvency is monitored daily by the Fed.
And Vicki, because we're short on time, I want to get Heather's reaction there to your 5 stars. Heather, go ahead.
Well, I think Vicki is right in the sense that a lot of people give the Fed 5 stars for what they did in 2020. You can definitely make an argument that the Fed stepped in and prevented another great financial crisis by acting super swiftly. I wrote a piece about this. Fed Chair Powell came back from a meeting in the Middle East in February of 2020, and he was much faster than the White House and Congress to realize that this pandemic was taking off. This was probably going to be a really bad economic event. And he got the members of his committee together really quickly, and they cut interest rates in early March twice, and way before Congress got their act together and passed any relief. And that's why we saw the stock market turn around pretty quickly. But ultimately, that's why we didn't probably have a banking crisis.
So what are you watching for out of the Fed now?
I think Vicky also made a good point that I don't think interest rates are going up anytime soon, maybe at the end of next year, but probably that's not a this year phenomenon. What I'm watching for this year is what's going to happen with inflation. We're going to get some more readings on that in the coming months and how the Fed reacts to that. But even more importantly, what Vicky was saying about the Fed is also buying still a very large number of about $120 billion a month in assets. Mm-hmm. And so that's mortgage securities that are helping keep mortgage rates low and also treasuries. And so they're, by the end of the summer, they're going to have to make a decision. Do we keep buying all those or do we pull back a little bit? Do we take off the floaties, basically, or the training wheels?
Heather, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Heather Long, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Coming up, we have the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, Neil Kashkari, is here. What do you want to ask him? 800-642-1234. We'll be back with the Fed president after a news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank president and CEO, Neil Kashkari. He's one of 12 regional Federal Reserve Bank presidents. District includes four states plus Michigan's Upper Peninsula and 26 counties of northwestern Wisconsin. What questions do you have about monetary policy as the economy rebounds? What do you want to know about the impact of interest rates near zero and the risks of inflation? 800-642-1234. President Neil Kashkari, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's great to be with you this morning.
So here we are as a country emerging from this catastrophic pandemic and recession. What is your take on the economic recovery as it stands now?
Well, I think it's off to a good start, but we are still in a deep hole. I'm very focused on Americans finding jobs. I'm very focused on the labor market. And by different measures, we're something like 7 or 8 or maybe even more million short in terms of workers and jobs than we were where we should have been pre-pandemic. So the economy is positioned for a very strong recovery, but we need to make sure that everybody who wants to find a job is able to find a job and we can put everybody back to work and really recover our economy.
Jobs are one thing, but, you know, both Wisconsin and Minnesota recently way underestimated the amount of tax collections they've received by billions of dollars. Do officials really have a good handle on what's happening with the economy?
Well, this isn't, you know, we've had many recessions in history and we always learn from prior recessions and study them. This one is very different. This one is not like the financial crisis of 2008. Which was caused by the bursting of the housing bubble. This is a pandemic, and this is like a natural disaster hammering the global economy, leading to a hard economic shutdown, and then hopefully a very fast recovery and a rebound. And one of the things that was different about this downturn compared to the last one is the U.S. Congress and the White House acted very aggressively to support American businesses and American families. And we think that that has really reduced the long-term damage to our economy and potentially positioned us for a very fast recovery. I hope that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, you oversaw the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, which was created to stabilize the financial system during the 08 financial crisis, also known as the bank bailout. How does that history of the Great Recession inform your thinking today on the recovery here on this economic crisis?
Well, it absolutely informs it because one of the things, you know, we prevented in 2008, and I was at the Treasury Department then, we prevented that financial crisis from becoming a Great Depression. But we still had a grindingly slow 10-year economic recovery. It took 10 years to put Americans fully back to work, and we cannot have another 10-year recovery. And so I think not only have my colleagues and I at the Federal Reserve learned from this, I think Congress learned from this and said we need to be much more aggressive this time so we don't have such a grinding recovery. Because if you're out of work for 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, that's devastating. And we need to do better. And I think everybody is committed to doing much better this time.
But on the flip side, I mean, I know that you're saying there was this underestimation of how severe the 08 crisis was. But when you look at the White House and the Biden administration and the amount of pandemic relief, has it gone the other direction? Is it too much because there's that threat of overheating the economy?
There is that threat, and we're paying very close attention to the data and the economic analysis. But let me just tell you, for the last 10 years, people kept saying, oh my gosh, we're overheating the economy. Oh my gosh, high inflation is about to come. Oh my gosh, we're out of workers. 100% of those calls were wrong. And every time we thought we've reached full potential, everybody's working, more Americans came off the sidelines and took jobs. And so, you know, we take our inflation mandate very seriously. We're paying attention to the data. But when 7 or 8 or 10 million Americans are still on the sidelines, I know we are a long way from fully recovering our economy.
We're talking with Neel Kashkari, who's president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, as we discuss the role of the Fed in the pandemic economic crisis and what he sees. You can join in. What questions do you have for the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank? What do you want the Fed to prioritize? 800-642-1234. Neel, here in Wisconsin, some people are calling for an end to the federal government's enhanced unemployment benefit, saying it is keeping people out of the job market from pursuing a job. Do you think it's time to end these benefits?
Well, I think there's some truth to those arguments. I'm not going to dismiss those arguments, and it makes common sense. I mean, if you're getting more money right now, and you know these benefits are going to expire no matter what, they're already going to expire in a few months, and the job market looks like it's strong, it makes intuitive sense that some people are saying, well, I'll just wait a few months, collect these benefits, and then go back to work in September. We also know that childcare has been a big issue with schools closed. Schools should hopefully be fully reopened by August and September. And we know people are still nervous about the virus. And as the vaccine rollout continues, and hopefully the virus continues to decline, I think people will feel safe. So all three of those factors, in my estimation, are having some effect. And I think that they will all get better by the fall. So I'm anticipating a very strong labor market recovery in the fall when those factors start to fall away.
You know, the Fed has been criticized over the years for not prioritizing low-income workers, for focusing on the big corporations and Wall Street. How can the Federal Reserve help the poor in this country?
Well, directly by what we're doing. I mean, we are very focused on getting Americans back to work. The most valuable asset most people have, because they don't own stocks or they may not own a house, the most valuable asset they have is their job. And by helping to rebuild the economy, put Americans back to work, we are directly trying to help those who are the lowest income of our colleagues and the lowest income of our neighbors. And one of the things that we saw at the end of the last expansion, 2017, 2018, 2019, we saw the strongest wage growth for the lowest income workers, which was great. They were long overdue for a raise. And that's why I'm very focused on at least getting back to that kind of an economy, that kind of a labor market, and maybe even going beyond that, so that those workers finally are enjoying some of the fruits of our economic growth.
So kind of putting a bow on this, should unemployment benefits be ended now, or would you suggest, you know, waiting until the fall is scheduled?
You know, I think that's for Congress to decide and state governors, and they're making those decisions at the state level. I think that that's appropriate. Many states have already decided to end them early. We'll see what effect that has on the labor market. I would certainly be opposed to extending them beyond where they are currently set to expire. Whether somebody wants to cut them off a couple months early, I don't think that's going to make a big difference in this, you know, in the trajectory of the U.S. economy. But I understand why some people are taking those actions.
Let's bring in Mark now in Madison. Hi, Mark. What is your question?
I'd like to know, what are the implications of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour?
Well, that's a great question. You know, the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul have both voted to increase their minimum wage to $15 an hour over a few years. And they both actually asked the Minneapolis Fed to conduct a long-term economic impact analysis. You know, intuitively, workers whose wages go up, they're better off. But if it leads businesses they can't hire as many workers and some workers lose their jobs, then there are trade-offs. And so I think so far the analyses that I've seen has said it's quite complicated on who are the winners and who are the losers. And it's going to depend on the broader macroeconomic environment. I mean, if you're starting in a recession with very high unemployment and you raise the minimum wage, that's probably going to have more downside than it is going to have beneficiaries. If you're in a very strong economy with a very tight labor market, then there will probably be fewer trade-offs. And so I'm sorry that I don't have a definitive answer for you yet. It's been studied. We continue to study it. I think it's going to depend on the local conditions on the ground, on whether or not there are more winners and losers and who those winners and losers are.
Mark, thank you. George now from Ashland has a question about the inner workings, the nuts and bolts, if you will, of the Federal Reserve Banks. George, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I'd just like to know how many people are employees of the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis, and what do they actually do on a day-to-day basis? What is their work? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your question. We have about 1,100 employees. We do a lot of different things. First of all, our job is to represent this region, which are Minnesota, the Dakotas, Montana, Upper Peninsula, Michigan, and Northwestern Wisconsin. We have a team of economists who work with me to understand what's happening in the regional, the national, and the global economy, who help advise me on monetary policy. We have bank regulators who regulate and supervise and inspect many banks across our region. We also have people who, for example, process cash. If you go to your ATM and you take out $20, that money will have started out in our vault, in our bank. And we've got these very sophisticated machines which process this cash and put cash out into the banks and take old currency from the banks. We have people who do work in low-income communities around the region to understand what's happening in those communities so that we are thinking about them in our monetary policy process. We also provide computing services and financial transactions for the banking system itself. So we do a lot of different things, but it's all under the mandate that Congress has given us, which is, hey, let's have stable prices in our economy. Let's have maximum employment, and let's have a financial system that is efficient and resilient for all Americans.
But I would imagine, though, that it's a little bit difficult with the diversity of your region. I mean, I feel like Montana would be a world away from the issues of northwestern Wisconsin, and maybe not. What do you see?
It is. I mean, it's a huge geography. We also have a branch office in Helena, Montana, which helps us get to know what's happening in Montana. And our region is as diverse in terms of our economy as the U.S. economy. All major sectors of the U.S. economy are represented in our region in scale. So I have a group of regional outreach economists who also travel the region, talking to small businesses, talking to workers, talking to farmers to understand what's happening. You know, we have to set monetary policy, one interest rate for the whole nation. And that's very complicated. We want to make sure our region's diversity is represented in that process and in that deliberation. And that's a big part of my job and my colleagues' job is to know what's happening across our region and bring that information to Washington, D.C. when we set interest rates for the country.
Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank President Neel Kashkari is with us on the state of the recovery and Federal Reserve's policy issues and just what it does. You can join in. Do you think that the Federal Reserve has a duty to address how discrimination and racial bias persist in the job market, in our housing system, in the broader economy? What measures do you think could lead to more equity? How do you want the Fed to act in these times? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, Neel Kashkari, as we discuss themes cutting across monetary policy. Are you an investor worried about slowing growth in our country? Are you worried about a recovery that worsens the growing divide in our nation between the rich and poor? How do you want the Fed to tackle social justice and racism in areas like the job market, like housing? Join in 800-642-1234. President Neel Kashkari is with us for about 9 more minutes. Neil, you know, 2 days after George Floyd was murdered by a Minneapolis police officer, you condemned the incident as evidence that institutional racism is actively taught and reinforced, you said. Why did you feel that you needed to speak up?
You know, George Floyd was killed not far, a couple miles from our bank. And, you know, I live here. I'm a resident of this region. My colleagues, the employees that we talked about a moment ago, they live here. This is in our community. And if we all don't speak out about what we see, if we see something wrong, then nothing is going to change. And so that's what brought, I mean, what struck me, I've seen other footage, of course, of somebody being killed in an interaction with police. What just struck me was how the officer Chauvin sat there for 9 minutes. He knew he was being recorded. He knew he was surrounded by witnesses and he didn't care. So he obviously didn't think he was doing anything wrong. And that was what was so different for me and why I spoke out about it.
The Fed has this initiative that looks at racism in the economy. How has racism damaged our economy?
Well, it limits our potential. You know, one of the mandates that Heather talked about that Congress has given us is maximum employment, as many Americans as possible working. We know that employment rates, the number of percentage of Americans who have jobs, Black Americans tend to trail white Americans. We know that the unemployment rate for Black Americans is almost always twice white Americans, even if you adjust for education. So a Black college graduate is more likely to have twice the unemployment than a white college graduate. And we only saw those ratios start to compress when the job market got really tight in the last recovery. So if, and I believe it is, racism is still playing a factor in our economy. And if it keeps people on the sidelines, that's not only unfair for them, that hurts our ability to achieve maximum employment, and it diminishes our economic potential for all of us. And so even if the Federal Reserve does not have specific tools to address these serious issues, if we can illuminate them through nonpartisan research and analysis, we think we can make a contribution so other policymakers, whether it's Congress or the state houses, they can take that data and put it to good use.
You've received some pushback. The top Republican on the Senate's Banking Committee, Senator Patrick Toomey, sent you a letter in May, I believe it was, criticizing the focus on race, saying it seems heavily laden with political and value judgments. How do you respond to those critics?
Well, our goal is to be nonpartisan and independent and look objectively at data and analysis. And, you know, at the Minneapolis Fed, we reach out to everybody across the aisle. We've had Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson speak at a conference in our bank on the regional economy. We've also had Democratic Senator from North Dakota, Heidi Heitkamp, spoke at our conference. We had Republican Governor Doug Burgum of North Dakota and Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison as speakers, for example. So we reach out to everybody across the aisle. When we see an economic issue that we think is important, we want to shine a light on it. And we want to do that using objective data and analysis where all views and all experts are welcome. And so I respectfully push back to the senator in a letter that I sent to him. And we're continued to be committed to this work.
No, I want to look at banks here again. You know, banks are arguing that they've been a source of strength in the pandemic and, you know, have put pressure on relaxing regulations. Does their performance in COVID indicate that banks are strong enough, that they're resilient?
Not the largest banks. I mean, first of all, I think small banks across our region really stepped up to help get the PPP loans out to their constituents, which was really important. And we're grateful that they did that. The biggest banks are saying, look how strong we were in COVID, just like you're saying. But the reason that they performed as well is because Congress effectively bailed out all of their borrowers. You know, how do these 10 or 20 million Americans who lost their jobs, how did they pay their mortgage? How did they make their credit card bills? How did they make their car payments? Because Congress was so aggressive and they did the right thing. I'm praising Congress for doing it. But that ultimately rescued the banks. And so I think the banks are being disingenuous when they said, look how strong we were during COVID. Therefore, you should relax regulations on us. We still think big banks need tougher regulations than they have today.
There's been criticism that the Fed is fueling a housing bubble by buying up billions of dollars in mortgage-backed securities. Heather Long at Washington Post just called them, you know, the floaties, and when will you take them off? What is your take on this criticism and buying up assets?
Well, we're not buying up houses, just to be clear. We're buying up treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities from Fannie and Freddie to provide economic stimulus to so we can have as strong an economic recovery as possible. You know, we are all, my colleagues and I are all paying very close attention to the data, the housing data, the broader economic data, and the fact that we're still somewhere between 7 and 10 million jobs short of where we should be. And so at the right time, we will, you know, come up with a plan and adjust our asset purchases. And eventually, when the economy is fully recovered, we will bring interest rates back up to more of a normal level. But as I said earlier, we are still in a deep hole, and I don't want to cut this recovery off prematurely.
Neel Kashkari, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. There's also tension among policymakers over inflation, a little hand-wringing there. Some economists have been sounding the alarm about inflation, others dismissing it. You know, at what point do we need to worry about inflation?
Well, we know that in this recovery, and this recovery, is, as we talked about earlier, unlike any recovery in any of our lifetimes, is different. And we know that reopening the recovery, there end up being glitches and supply chain issues as businesses have to adjust. And so some of the high inflation readings we expected, and we have to watch them. Are these things ultimately going to correct? You know, lumber prices soared. Lumber prices are still high, but they're starting to fall back down to earth. So are these really going to be sustained or not? So we're paying very close attention to the data. The biggest driver of inflation historically has been workers. Mm. When we really do put all Americans back to work, and when we really do run out of workers, and businesses then start to see real struggles because they have to compete against each other by bidding up wages, that's when I'm going to start to get worried that, okay, maybe high inflation is really here to stay. If it's just these short-term effects of the reopening and the adjustments of supply chains, those are more likely to be transitory. And so we're not prejudging it. We're going to pay close attention to the data. But right now, it looks like it's more transitory than it is fundamental.
One more thing here. You're pushing this initiative in Minnesota to pass a constitutional amendment that would guarantee every child the right to a quality education. Can you tell us about this goal?
Yeah, Minnesota has some of the worst education disparities in the nation, between not just black and white disparities and white and indigenous. Low-income white children across Minnesota are being badly served by our education system. So I teamed up with former Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Alan Page, and we've proposed what we call the Page Amendment to create the civil right for every child to get a quality public education and then make delivering on that right the state's highest priority. What's exciting about it is we've united Republicans and Democrats, Democrats of color from the Twin Cities with conservative Republicans from rural Minnesota. They are united saying enough is enough. We need to prioritize all of our children. You know, it's been introduced in the state house and in the state senate. Ultimately, the legislature has to pass it and then it'll go to the voters. We continue to work very hard on this.
Neel, thank you for joining us.
Hey, I really appreciate it. This was a great conversation.
Neel Kashkari, president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Earlier, we talked with Washington Post economic correspondent Heather Long. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.